Welcome to Office Hours with Adam Peterson, where I talk to business owners, employees, entrepreneurs and experts to find answers to those day-to-day questions about life and work in Luxembourg. If you have questions you'd like answered, let me know at adam.peterson@rtl.lu or on LinkedIn. But for now, on to today's show. Unless this is your first episode, you'll know that each Office Hours has a different theme, either a segment of the economy, a business activity, or an interview from a leader or an entrepreneur. And I don't know how I'm going to do this episode because I think we could do all of the above. In the studio, I have Crystal von Oostrom. I want to quiz her on artificial intelligence in the economy, her entrepreneurial activities, establishing a company in Luxembourg, and her career journey and how she got there. So let's see if we can combine all four episodes into one. So welcome to the show, Crystal.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I think you have two jobs at the moment. AI venture partner at Open Ocean, and you're the founder of Desai. What are those jobs and are they compatible with each other?
So going through those two jobs, so a venture partner means that I work with a venture capitalist company called Open Ocean, trying to find the best AI companies in Europe to invest in and to support. So it's both helping assess the companies, but also, once we have invested in them, helping them get the best out of themselves.
What's the geographical remit of that? Does Brexit mean Brexit? Does it include Britain as well?
So it also includes Britain. We also go deep into Eastern Europe, where there's amazing undiscovered AI hubs, all of geographic continent Europe.
Desai. So tell me about Desai.
So Desai is an AI company which aims to help people furnish their homes. Anecdotally, when I moved here, I had to furnish a house, and it was one of the biggest headaches I have faced in a long time. And I decided that actually, if I had the right technology, I could do this within minutes. So this is exactly what I'm building for people.
DES and then AI.
Correct.
Okay. And so the idea, you walk through your house with your phone empty, and then it would show you all the different ways of filling it with furniture. Is that the way it would work?
More or less, yes. So as you say, you film a room, you give your budget, you tell us which pictures of interiors you like and you don't like, a couple of preferences. So maybe I don't. Maybe you have a dog and you want the furniture to be easy to clean. Yep. And then off the back of that, we give you the opportunity to design interiors in a very easy way with furniture from all over the internet.
So it would go to IKEA, for example, and scrape data from IKEA with the dimensions and then put that IKEA piece of furniture into your room. Is that how it would work?
Exactly. So it's based on the furniture you already have and the size that you have available. We generate a layout. In the living room, you will need a couch, you will need side tables, you will need a coffee table. With your tastes, literally you're just telling us, I like these pictures and I don't like these others. We can determine which ones you are most likely to like. And then with the size, the budget, the taste, we make selections that work very well together from an interior design perspective that you could just buy.
And how will you generate the cash from that? Will you generate money from the furniture company whose furniture gets selected? So will they pay you to be included and recommended to customers, or will you charge the customer, or is there a different business model to it?
So I'm a big believer in open source and open platforms. So for us, it's very important that this is free to the end consumer. And as you say, actually, it's then the commission that gets paid by the furniture retailers when you actually make a sale for them.
But you seem to be playing on both teams there, because you're a venture capitalist who's deciding to fund companies, and then you're also setting up a company as well.
Yes, that's right. It's actually a very unique and lucky position to be able to sit on both sides of the table, where you get a much deeper understanding of the needs and the concerns of both parties.
So you're better as a venture capitalist being able to assess the business of AI companies, and also as someone who I imagine is looking for funding from places, you are understanding the perspective of the venture capitalists as well.
Exactly. So in Europe, only 8% of venture capital funds are actually what they call operator-led, which is by people who've actually set up companies. While in the US, that's more than 50%. And I am a big believer that the best advice you can give to founders is when you've stood in their own shoes.
So tell me about that journey then. So you were born in the Netherlands. How did you go from the Netherlands to Luxembourg? Did you just come hop over the border, or do you go other places in between?
I had quite a journey throughout Europe along the way. So my parents, when I was very young, moved to the south of France where I grew up, and I did most of my schooling until high school.
That sounds terrible.
It's there's worse places to be. Anecdotally, I was actually one of the, at the age of 15, I did my baccalaureate, so I'm one of the youngest graduates ever really in France to pass a baccalaureate, but that's by the by. And then decided to go study at Oxford University, where I did economics and management. Got very frustrated on how bad economics models were at predicting things. Trained as a safari guide for 1 year.
Where was that?
After I graduated, I was quite frustrated, didn't know what to do with my life.
So you took people on safari in punts through Oxford, or did you go somewhere else?
So moved to Southern Africa and trained as a safari guide in Southern Africa. Didn't think through that they don't employ foreigners, really. So made it quite quickly back to Europe. Then did a master's in complex systems modeling at King's College. Now, at the time, you couldn't study AI. It was not a thing. We had one small module called machine learning. And nobody knew at the time how big this was going to become. Then joined McKinsey, as they had just acquired this company called Quantum Black, which was one of the earliest AI companies out there in the F1 space. And they were just building up their AI practice. So I was lucky to join as they were building their AI practice as one of the leaders and early movers in this space.
So the company, what were they doing with F1?
So with F1, what they were doing is that they were doing AI simulations to be able to figure out what to change on the car to be able to make it go faster.
So aerodynamics and...
For example, yes. Okay. And McKinsey acquired them to be able to start building an AI practice. And I joined around that time, which was luck that happened. Had the luck to be able to be one of the first people working and building up that practice. And then my mentor gave me the funny advice of saying, well, in the future, we will need people who have experience bringing AI to the real world. So you should probably go out there.
And that was a mentor within McKinsey.
Yes.
Effectively saying, get out of McKinsey, go and do something else.
Yes. If you want to make it in AI, go and actually build AI. Don't just consult on it. Don't just sell it. Don't actually go and build it.
Oh, I like this person. So where did you go?
So I then joined this small, well, at the time, unknown startup called Tractable in London, which 5 years later became the first computer vision. So computer vision is AI being able to understand images. Unicorn, so $1 billion company in the UK. And it was one of the first, it was the first unicorn from Entrepreneur First.
Congratulations, fantastic. And then from Tractable?
So then from Tractable, once it became a unicorn, a lot of people had done their time, basically. And
a lot of hard work to get it there, I would imagine.
Oh, incredibly long days. But so much fun. So much fun. I do highly recommend Startup Worlds. It's a lot of fun, even though it's incredibly hard work. And then I decided to use that knowledge to help companies. And within that kind of passion of wanting to help startups, I got in touch with a venture capital fund, Open Ocean, who asked me to join their team.
Okay, and then since then, you then started Desire as well.
Exactly, and since then, I've had the opportunity to move to Luxembourg and decided to start my own company.
On that journey, McKinsey, I imagine, can probably be quite traditional, male-dominated, and then that master's you did, that sounded really techie. Were you a woman in a man's world?
Absolutely. Absolutely. At Oxford, I think we were 5 women out of 125 students. My master's, we were 2 out of 15. Even when I joined Tractable, it were mostly men. But in my experience, it actually played to my advantage being a woman.
Interesting. Tell me more about that.
So when I started my career, I thought I would try and play the men's game as a woman. And very quickly came to the realization that actually as a woman, I have strengths that can play to my advantage. Such as, for example, handling difficult customers is a typical example that just innately it is easier to do as a woman, or even managing teams. So managing research teams takes a lot of finesse and subtlety. And the moment I started leaning into those strengths, it actually really played to my advantage.
And the massive generalization, I understand, but along with that massive generalization is that women generally have a higher EQ, emotional quotient. So being aware of that and using that superpower actually helped.
Exactly, exactly. In addition to that, people are much more aware nowadays. So I could even go as far as saying that there are some opportunities that maybe I would not have gotten if I weren't a woman. And I got lucky along the way.
As someone who was the youngest ever, or among the youngest ever people to get a baccalaureate in France, you deserve it, I would say, as well. It's not as though you didn't deserve those opportunities. You're obviously pretty talented too. Which
is,
okay, I don't know if that's maybe hard to judge. And I wanted to ask that question though. So how do you think you have been successful, and where would you attribute that success? A lot across the three pillars of hard work. You worked really hard when you were working on the Unicorn company Tractable. Talent. You're obviously talented if you got the baccalaureate so young. And luck. Maybe you've been in the right place at the right time.
I would say hard work and luck. Hard work to make the most out of the opportunities you get. Luck to even get those opportunities in the first place, where if you'd asked me just straight out of high school if I'd guessed that I'd end up where I am today, the answer I would have probably said no. But somehow with life pushed me into certain directions, including my master's and my first and my second job, which just to a certain extent were luck that I was at the right place at the right time.
Thank you for that answer. I think you're probably being a little bit harsh on yourself, and I think there's a fair chunk of talent too. So it's been great to get to know you during part one. We'll take a quick break now, and in part two, we'll dig into the world of AI. Welcome back to RTL's Office Hours. In part one, we explored the inspiring career of Crystal van Oosterom. Now in part two, we're diving into the fascinating world of artificial intelligence. From its everyday uses to the ethical questions it raises, AI is shaping our future in remarkable ways. Stay tuned for a thought-provoking discussion you won't want to miss. Is the introduction that ChatGPT recommended I use to kick off the second half of the show. To me, it's generic, it's bland, and it's clearly written by AI. ChatGPT did know about the show, but it missed my usual phrase of chewy questions. And that's where I want to start now, the chewy questions about AI. So Crystal, help me with some of the basics. Everything's labeled AI now. Predictive text on my Nokia 2210 in the mid-2000s would probably now be marketed as powered by AI. So when we say AI, what are we talking about?
So if you look at the Oxford Dictionary definition, it says it's software that is able to do tasks that used to only be feasible by humans. But I don't like that definition.
Because that's anything. So much.
In the Industrial Revolution, that was robots and machinery, right? What's different nowadays? What is AI from a technical perspective? It's just statistical models that are based on data it has been trained on.
And there's different types. So people talk about, I can never say the word, generative and predictive and discriminative. So tell me about what they are and the difference between them.
So there are two major families of models. Generative AI, which is, for example, the ChatGPTs of this world, are the models that generate actual data. So that could be a text, that could be a video, it could be an image. Discriminative AI, on the other hand, are models who make a decision. So, for example, you give a picture of a cat, and it can tell you, is it a cat or a dog? Or it can predict whether a loan is a good loan or a bad loan. Yeah. But the remit of what it's able to do is much more limited.
So we're making that really confusing, because generative AI, such as ChatGPT, can itself be discrimination in kind of the ethical sense, that it can, you ask a generative AI machine to give you a picture of a doctor, and it gives you a white man, for example. So is that, am I correct in that understanding, that generative AI can be discriminatory in our legal view of the world, but that's different to predictive / discriminative AI?
Yes, exactly. Okay. So both AIs can actually be discriminatory.
Both can be
discriminatory. But the wording discriminative is because you're asking it to classify and discriminate between cat and dog, for example. Yeah,
okay. So it can be the predictive one can, because it says a good loan based on some characteristics, which may be protected characteristics. And the,
for example.
Okay, got it. So the other thing that, well, I nearly got it. The other thing that I hear a lot is about this debate around power. So my phone can run on a charge for 2 days. And it says, powered by AI in my phone. But then you hear these conversations about AI requiring energy. And there was a 2017 podcast, more or less, will Bitcoin use more electricity than the US? So help me understand this connection between AI and energy and big server farms.
There's two elements to running a model. One of them is actually building it and training it. And that can take weeks, that can even take months for the biggest models out there. And that costs a lot of energy. Computer, it's as if you're running your computer at full capacity for days and days on end. Then there's the inference part. So what they call inference in industries, when you ask it a question. So you've trained it and you're just using it in the real world. And for that, it also uses energy because it needs to run the model on a lot of the data every time you ask it a question. Now,
so when you ask the question, it's going back to that big server farm where the data is being trained, and it's asking the question through that,
exactly,
through that computer.
Exactly.
Okay.
So when you have a model, the model itself is software. In theory, you could download it on any kind of hardware. You could run it just like computer software.
Yep.
You can run it on any computer. But you do need a hell of a lot of computers, let's put it this way, for a lot of these big, big models.
And your company then, do you create your own AI or do you use someone else's? Help me understand, do you have a big stack of computers that you're training your own models on, or are you utilizing someone else's?
We initially looked, just because it's a smart thing to do, if we could use existing models. And as expected, they were just not good enough at the tasks that we wanted them to do. So we ended up, we're currently still in the process of labeling thousands and thousands of data points to be able to teach our own models, which we've already developed quite a few, but it grows exponentially how much data you need to create to teach your own models. Now, a lot of the models that hit the press today are the large language models, but there is a trend in the industry towards much, much smaller models. And these smaller models, you can just run on your laptop. So we aim for our models to be as small as necessary, basically, as possible, and as big as necessary, so that you could run it probably even on your phone.
So we'll get a different approach. So ChatGPT, large language model, like everything that the world has ever written, it's been trained on. So then we're going to move away from that big generic case to specific use cases and models, which then don't require as much information and many data points, because we're asking you to do something really specific as opposed to predict what I could say in the next sentence, you know, which could be absolutely anything. Is that right?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So because the world is much smaller in terms of what you ask from the model, it doesn't need to be as knowledgeable. And that means that the models are faster to run. They are cheaper to run, but they are also, to some extent, most likely better at that very specific task.
You've decided to start up your AI company in Luxembourg. So why did you decide to do that here?
Luxembourg, I would say, is one of the most generous countries in the world when it comes down to AI and technology startups. From the fact that they give you access with Lux provides to supercomputers in very, very heavily subsidized ways. But they also subsidize R&D costs up to 80% if you partner with the government.
So that's not even just a tax break. They put in cash as well.
Correct. So just direct subsidies for true breakthrough technology that you're developing.
And they're not even demanding a share of the company for that. It's just, not quite the right word, but free cash, effectively.
Effectively, yes.
Oh, fantastic. So Luxembourg's good at attracting people to Luxembourg to start them up. How good do you think Luxembourg's going to be at keeping people here? We hear about lots of companies that set up in Europe and then disappear over the horizon to Silicon Valley.
That is not even a Luxembourg issue. I would say that's a general Europe issue, where one in four founders of unicorns in the US are actually European people who left to the US. So it's a very high number. Generally, Luxembourg is very good at attracting them, but it is still relatively immature as an ecosystem, where there are certain elements which still make it very difficult for companies to stay and grow. One notable example is stock options. So startups usually don't have much money.
Yeah.
So a big part of the pay to their employees is through shares, so yeah. parts of the company. And nearly every country in Europe has favorable tax regimes to make it attractive. Luxembourg doesn't. So these kind of barriers make it quite hard for companies to scale.
Yeah, I did not know that. Yeah, I saw something recently which was a bubble chart with all of the US companies over 10 billion or some number and the ones in Europe. And it was almost like a rounding error, the European ones. Do you think your company, are you going to change that dynamic? Are you going to be a big circle on that chart and remain within Europe, do you think?
I hope so. For me, I have strong roots to Europe as a European who's spent most of my life living in Europe. But that being said, I have seen companies who, even just in terms of funding, have had to move for the survival of the company to the US. And most European companies, if they want to truly become big, have no choice but to tackle the US market because it's so big.
And there's an adage which is, whilst Europe regulates technology, the US makes money from it. Do you buy that argument? Are we being over eager on the regulation in Europe?
So in the short term, I think that this adage makes sense, absolutely. But in the long term, as the quality of the AI will become more and more important, regulation feels to me like a good idea, yeah. Absolutely. Because there's also an adage in AI, which is crap in, crap out.
Yeah.
So the worse the data, the worse the training, the worse the model. And the biggest danger with AI is that if a model is bad, you often don't realize or know that it's bad.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous.
Yeah. When we first met, I think you were saying you were having difficulty attracting the right level of talent to Luxembourg around AI. How is the talent pool and getting people to move to Luxembourg to work on AI?
In an ideal world, you've put out a job spec and you have someone in Luxembourg applying. Unfortunately, because it's still young, there are not that many very experienced people in AI yet, which means that you have to go out searching in Europe to attract them. Now, once again, the government is very generous, for example, with the Impatriate regime, where they give up to 50% of salary tax breaks when you come, if you have a specific skill set. So the government is definitely helping with this. But it is a big effort for startups to have to go hunting around all of Europe for the right talent and lobbying them to move to Luxembourg rather than just hiring someone locally.
Yeah, it's just kind of sat there waiting. So we've looked globally in some of the Luxembourg context. Let's just take it down to the individual. So before we were recording, we were talking about some of the things we listen to and read about AI and whether it will or will not change the world. So what's your view on how AI would enter our lives? And a follow-up question is, and if people want to educate themselves, what would you recommend they do?
So I do believe AI, people say it's going to be in everything you touch and do, to a large extent they'll be right, where I cannot name you a single industry today that has no AI applications and is not going to use it in some way, shape or form. So you will be interacting with it, whether you know it or not. And a lot of it can be back-end, like your bank, for example, using AI to figure out if you're the right candidate for a loan or not. When it comes down to educating, I think that there are a lot of researchers who are becoming more and more vocal about what the limits and the capabilities are of AI, and they don't necessarily get a platform compared to people more on the business side, for example. And for example, Jan LeCun is a very famous AI godfather who has very interesting views on this. And unfortunately today, it's not necessarily hitting the mainstream yet.
Yeah, I think what you were saying there, maybe a little bit ago as well, around garbage in, garbage out. If I think about at the start of this segment, when I did the introduction that ChatGPT produced, it was very bland, it was very predictable, it was very AI. if you're doing something which is creative, then I think you need to put a bit of yourself into the work. And I was interviewing some artists a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying that their work includes their personality. So I can see how it can make a big difference to the back end, but then Excel makes a big difference to the back end. I can't code Excel. I know where to put the numbers, I know how to do things, but I don't really need to understand the coding that sits behind Excel and how that works. I just need to understand the limitations and what a circular reference is and those sorts of things. Do you think people should focus on the use and application of AI more than how it works?
So one of the biggest problems today in AI, as we see it, is exactly what you say, the use. So I recently read a survey by OpenView who interviewed 700 software companies, corporate software companies, and 80% of them had invested in AI, but only 15% had been able to monetize it. Now, this brings the question of, okay, we now have this technology. You don't need to know exactly how it's built. However, you probably want to know its limitations. The hard question now is, what are we actually going to do with it and how are we going to make it useful? Especially because it's expensive. It's not software, which is relatively cheap. AI is actually very expensive, so you need to make it do something very valuable for it to make sense. And that is something that businesses are struggling with.
So I think it's fair to say that I've learned more about AI on this show. So thank you for your time today, Crystal. And if people want to get in contact with you or your company, how would they do that?
You can reach out to me, for example, via LinkedIn, Crystal Van Oostrom.
So thank you very much, and thanks to the listeners. So that's it for today's episode. If you have feedback and questions on this topic or any other, drop me a line at adam.peterson@rtl.lu or on LinkedIn.